Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Longtime researcher Mariana Chilton is a professor of practice in the Department of Nutrition at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She founded the Center for Hunger-Free Communities, where she launched Witness to Hunger, a movement to increase women's participation in the National Dialogue on Hunger and Poverty. She's also the author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, Why We Must Unlearn Everything We Think We Know and Start Again. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Chilton.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
There's a lot to unpack here, but before we dig into the book, let's start with what's been in the news. The federal government shutdown, the pause of assistance programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, which is now funded again. As you watched the news about the federal government shutdown and as it dragged on and you heard about SNAP, what struck you? What were you thinking?
I was thinking, well, these are the values that we've been trying to struggle against in America for many, many generations. It was just amazing to see the Trump administration and the people at the United States Department of Agriculture be so upfront about how willing they were to cause harm and to hurt the American people. There was no reason to restrict SNAP benefits. SNAP benefits are an entitlement program, so they were actively breaking the law. SNAP is always meant to be funded through difficult times and even during times of government shutdowns. So they took an extra step to be extra vindictive. And for me, it proved something that I've been trying to get across for years, is that at the root of hunger and food insecurity is disrespect and violence.
Organizations and Democratic states sued to compel the administration to fund SNAP, and President Trump defied lower court rulings. He took the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court. This all happened, and then eventually Congress restored the funding. But how have other presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, regarded food stamps in the past, and how have other presidents dealt with the program?
I'd say since the inception of the food stamp program, which was in, really it actually started during the Great Depression, and then it became modernized in the late 60s and became a really important cornerstone of the war against poverty in the late 60s, and then really grew in popularity in the 1970s, most American presidents have been very supportive of the program. Number one, it helps to prevent hunger. It's the number one hunger prevention program we have in the country. And it got started because doctors and nurses and physician's assistants and others were seeing young children, babies, actually die of starvation and malnutrition. So SNAP was a major program to help prevent that, along with the Women, Infants, and Children program called WIC. So it's been a very popular program as well. It's been very popular among people who live in rural areas because it helps to support farms. So it's something that brings America together. We consider it to be a part of the fabric of who we are in the United States. So it's been generally it's been what I consider to be a darling, a bipartisan darling of both left and right, because the SNAP program helps people stay healthy, prevents hunger, supports farms, keeps grocery stores up and running. And for every $1 that's spent in SNAP, up to $1.50 to $1.70 gets generated in local economies. So it's been a way of actually stimulating local economies as well.
So you mentioned that the first food stamp program started in the 1930s, and then a permanent food stamp program was enacted by Congress in 1964. That was during the Johnson administration. Do these early versions resemble the modern one we have today at all?
No, they don't. What they do keep together is the relationship between farms and farmland and SNAP benefits. So it keeps legislators who represent different, you know, farmers, family farms, and also big farms. It keeps that group of people together with people who live who represent areas with very high poverty rates. So they want to make sure that there's a relationship with how we grow food in America and SNAP benefits. The modern food stamp program doesn't, it is all electronic. It comes on an EBT card. It's called Electronic Benefits Transfer. And it can be used in grocery stores and swiped like a credit card. And it can be used to buy groceries and only groceries and not food that has been, like, you can't buy hot pizza with it and you can't buy other kinds of things like cleaning products and cigarettes and those kinds of things. And it's been modernized and it's a lifeline to low-income families across America. 42 million Americans, 42 people in the United States participate in the program, and 90% of the people who participate in SNAP are American citizens and were born here. And the other 10% are immigrants who are here legally and who have been here for at least 5 years.
There was a lot of activity during the government shutdown around the idea of hunger. Food banks, farms, grocery stores, communities heading up lots of drives. Why hasn't that been enough?
Okay, now we're getting into the deep issues, which is why I wrote my book.
Yeah.
But first of all, we have to remember that emergency food is a charity model. Most emergency food assistance is in a charity model, and that... is when I'm talking about like big food banks that then send out food to smaller food pantries. And what food banks can do, they're meant to be a place of last resort. They're not meant to be the number one program. So again, the fact that the SNAP program can reach 42 million people in the United States, and it primarily supports working families with children, it supports people with disabilities, and it supports people who are elderly to buy their groceries, along with veterans and active duty military in the United States, it can the SNAP program can immediately help people today, and it can immediately respond to economic downturns. And if there's some type of a disaster in a community, a flood, some other kind of situation, then SNAP benefits can be immediately turned on and made available for people to buy groceries. What SNAP does is it helps people, they can choose their own groceries, they can choose the kinds of food that they want. There's a way of, it's a way of purchasing food and not losing your dignity. The emergency food assistance program, food programs, such as those that are supported by food banks, are an important component of addressing hunger. But again, it's for when a family has had like a fire or has an emergency. And that's when people often have to wait in line. They have to take what they're given. They're considered to be sort of a passive recipient. They have really no say in what's going on with the type of food that they can get. And it's not enough for them to last more than 3 days, sometimes much less. And that system is not really a system. It's not coordinated. It's sort of dependent on whether there's food or whether they have staffing or volunteers that can keep the place open. So it really only helps about 5 to 10% of people who are food insecure. So then again, the number one program to address food insecurity in the United States is the SNAP program. One other thing, if I could just add, there are other kinds of programs, mutual aid programs, that are really exciting. And we see those have been around for a long time. I mean, people have been using that for generations to support people in their community, to share resources, to have a reciprocal relationship with their neighbors. So what we saw most recently during the illegal withholding of SNAP benefits by the United States government, we saw lots of wonderful community groups coming together, finding ways that they could buy groceries for their neighbors, feed their neighbors, do community meals. And there are a lot of mutual aid programs that help people sort of be not a passive recipient of charity, but be an active member of a network of people that's giving food and receiving food, where there's a sense of reciprocity and mutuality.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking this hour about hunger in America with author Mariana Chilton of the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You also write that millions of people who are going hungry, they're more white people than Black, Indigenous, Latinx, immigrant. More white people experience hunger. Those percentages, can you tell me how that's a more complicated story? I would think that there's a lot of people out there who probably don't think that the higher percentage is white.
Yes, well, that's because we have been so steeped in discriminating against each other and trying to distinguish ourselves from those others who are poor and can't afford food. So, yeah, we have to pull back and really consider what's going on in the United States. The vast majority of people who report food insecurity, and by food insecurity, I mean lack of access to enough food for an active and healthy life, which is sort of an administrative term for what many of us refer to as hunger. It has two components. One is hunger or having enough, and the other one is for an active and healthy life, is enough of the right kinds of foods. So the most people who report food insecurity are people who are white, and that's in the millions. But what happens is that when you think about the percentage of the population, the percentage of the white population versus the percentage of the black population or the Latinx population or native populations, that's where you see inequities. That's where you see injustices in how food insecurity is spread across America. So we know that, again, 42 million Americans participate in SNAP, almost the same, maybe about 40 million people experience food insecurity or have reported it. The vast majority are white, but the percentage of the white population is between 8 to 10%. The percentage of the black population and Latinx populations, and this I'm talking about families with children, is about 25 to 30%. So the rates of food insecurity and hunger are 2 to 3 times that of white families. Okay, so the rates of food insecurity and hunger among Black and Latinx folks is 2 to 3 times that of white families. When we think about female-headed households or women-headed households, they also have extremely high rates of food insecurity when they're compared to two-parent households. So that's 30% of women-headed households. Then bringing it to Native folks, depending on the nation or the tribe or the band of people that you're learning about who report food insecurity, that rate can be between 25 to 80% of Native communities. So that's where we have to start to unpack what's really going on here. Why is it that people of color and Native folks, why is it that women have much higher rates of food insecurity and hunger? Something's going on there.
In your research, which spans years, this is all highlighted in your book, you talked with dozens of women who experienced hunger, and what they share in your book is raw and emotional. One of the women we meet first is Juline, and she describes what hunger feels like. I'd like you to read a short passage from her. It's on page 39.
Yeah, sure. Remember these quotes that are in the book are actually recordings that I did with them, so nothing can really replace the original voice of Juline. I'll do my best. And it's a very brief segment. She said, "I know how it feels to be so hungry until you feel like you can't walk, you can't sit, you can't lay with yourself comfortable. And I know how it feels to be so hungry you feel like you'd eat just about anything."
When you heard her describe it this way, what stayed with you?
It was chilling to hear it. And what has stayed with me throughout my lifetime, of my adult lifetime working on food insecurity, is this concept of you can't lay with yourself comfortable. The moment she said that, it's almost like it penetrated my own being, and I have not been able to lay with myself comfortable ever since, because I know that there are so many people who are experiencing food insecurity and hunger, who experience so much trauma, that are struggling, and that I'm a part of it. I'm entangled in it. And there's no reason that we should have hunger in America. There's no reason that people should be at this state of deprivation. The earth provides more than enough food for the human population and the animal population. It is so plentiful and abundant, and yet we allow this kind of thing to happen. And none of us, really, once we hear this, none of us at this point should be laying with ourselves comfortable.
Yeah, Juline also presented you with a painting she created after you two talked. She said she was thinking about the interview and she was thinking about hunger and dignity. And it reminded her that even during times when she had nothing, even the nothing was falling apart. That hits you just emotionally. Even the nothing I had was falling apart. So you included a picture of the painting. It's on page 34 of your book. Can you tell us about the painting and why you decided to include this in the book as a piece of telling the story of hunger in America?
Yes. Really, you know, when you start to do work and you start to work with alongside of people and learn about their experiences, there's a relationship that gets developed of just a deep human connection. And when I first met Julene, I met her at a food pantry called at Zion Baptist Church in Philadelphia. And when she came to my office for the interview, she didn't want me to come to her home. So she came to the office. We talked for 3 hours straight, in which she schooled me about what the experience of hunger was like, in which she said that she had told me things that she had told no one ever. And I think there was a sort of a sense of safety with a stranger where she knew that, you know, she was meant to be able to teach the world about the experience and that there was really nothing to lose. So I saw her again at a food, so that was the interview. And then I saw her again at the same food pantry about a year later. I was there volunteering and, you know, just seeing what was going on. And she came up to me and she said, "Hey," I said, "Oh, hi, Julene, I remember you." And she was surprised I remembered her name. She said, "Yeah, I was wondering if I could do another interview." And I said, "Well, that study is over." And she said, "Well, actually, what I really need is some money. My son just got out of prison and I need some money to help him out." And I said, "Well, I don't have any money on me, but if you come to my office, I have money, I have some leftover money there, and I'd love to also talk with you about what I learned from you and from the others that I spoke with about hunger." So I didn't actually expect to see her, but there she was. The next day, she showed up at my office, and she showed up with this painting. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Mariana, this is my gift for you, because this, what you're doing is really important. When I realized that I hadn't told anybody else about my experiences, I realized that what you're doing is really important, and I want you to teach the world about what this experience is like. And you can use this image, and let me explain it to you what's going on there." So the reason I focus the book, I start the book out with her painting. It's a self-portrait of her. Then she's sitting. It's the sort of the old trope of hunger that we have of a person in a barrel, and they have a barrel because they don't have any clothes. But she's in the barrel, and the barrel is falling apart. There's a nail that's coming out, and the image is of her looking straight at you. Like, no matter where you are looking at that painting, she's watching you. So in the same way that when she said, I can't lay with myself comfortable when she is experiencing hunger, when she gave me that painting, it has stayed with me for life, and I am obligated. She's looking at me, obligating me to teach the world about what that experience is like.
We are talking with author Mariana Chilton, author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, and she's staying with us for the hour. Coming up, we're going to talk more about hunger and its connection with health. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about hunger in America, and it's not just about food. Peel back the layers, and often those going without are women, dealing with a range of societal issues. Generational trauma, racism, discrimination, and violence. They are pitted against those with more power, privilege, and the ability to make and shape policy. Still with us is longtime researcher Mariana Chilton, a professor of practice in the Department of Nutrition at UMass Amherst, and she's the author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, Why We Must Unlearn Everything We Think We Know and Start Again. Thanks again for being here with us today, Mariana.
So happy to be here. It's wonderful to have an extended amount of time to talk about hunger.
So another woman that you interviewed is Celeste, and she describes her own experience with hunger. Can you read what she said? This is on page 40.
Yes. Again, this was a recording. Her voice is far more deep and interesting and superior to mine. I'll do my best. She said, "I was living on the streets, in the snow and sleet and rain, and sleeping on the benches, pregnant. Yeah. I had slept in this one room. It was more cold in there than it was outside. I wanted to go back outside and sleep because it was more warm outside than it was in there. I was pregnant, and half the days I didn't eat, and the other half of the days I did. So I know the meaning of being hungry and wanting food, and being without lights, and being without water, and being without gas."
And Celeste's words show there that hunger is not a standalone issue. It often comes with a lack of other necessities too, right? I mean, she mentions lights, water, and gas. Yeah.
That's right. So hunger does not happen in a vacuum. And oftentimes people will start to make trade-offs between paying for rent or paying for food, paying for their utilities or being late on their utilities in order to feed themselves and feed their families. So it's never that a family is doing just fine and then all of a sudden doesn't have money for food. It is a interdependent sort of series of deprivations that happens. One of the most deeply concerning types of trade-offs that families will make is a trade-off between paying for medicine and paying for food. And what happens when we all know that when you're taking medicine, you need to make sure that your nutrition is good and that sometimes you need to take medicine with food. And if you're taking medicine without food, it can actually have very damaging effects. Or, I mean, I know a woman that I worked with for many years, actually, who needed to have her mental health medication and her heart medication, but she was running out of medicines. What she would do is take her pills every other day rather than every day. So these are the kinds of trade-offs that families have to make. And it's heartbreaking. It's unbearable. And this is why we have to think beyond food. Food is not going to solve food insecurity and hunger. Yes, it's really important, but it's not the only thing we should be focusing on.
You write about adverse childhood experiences, also known as ACE, is a component that scientists now consider when they're evaluating hunger. Can you talk to me about the importance of that connection using adverse childhood experiences, ACE?
Yes, we refer to them as ACEs, actually, mm-hmm. because there are multiple types of adversities. Early in my research, talking with people who experienced food insecurity, I thought, I was quite naive and I thought, oh, I'll just talk about groceries and having enough money for groceries. So my question started out with, where do you go grocery shopping for food? What happens when you don't have money for food? And what would happen almost immediately within their same response is they would talk about violence in the home, how they were concerned about their safety, how when they were children, they didn't have enough money, their families didn't have enough money for food, or that they had experienced some type of violence or neglect. So it started to really bother me because I was unprepared for this level of pain and suffering that they were experiencing. And actually, it turned out that the most important thing for the women that I spoke with, especially, was not being able to have food, but feeling safe in their own home, feeling safe in their communities. And you can read more about that in the book. I spend a significant amount of time to try to demonstrate how not having enough money for food is really related to how women are treated in their families and in our society, how Black folks are treated in their neighborhoods, how the transportation systems are not enough in Black neighborhoods, and that has to do with racism and discrimination on a structural level. So, as a scientist as well, I was measuring food insecurity and I was measuring people's ability to pay for rent and utilities, the things that Celeste was talking about, gas, housing, those kinds of things. But I wanted to learn more about what had been happening in the homes of the people we were talking to when they were children, because so much was coming out in the qualitative research or in their stories. So adverse childhood experiences are experiences that happen before the age of 18 that have to do with emotional abuse or with experiences with physical abuse, or having a parent in the household that was in prison, or witnessing a mother or stepmother being beaten. These are really upsetting things, very understandable, very difficult to talk about. And most of the people who were measuring food insecurity were never thinking about violence. Well, through this study that I was running in Philadelphia, that's a part of a multi-site network called Children's Health Watch, which is still ongoing right now, I integrated a measure of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and food insecurity among the people that we talked to in the hospital to find out, is there a relationship? And unfortunately, sure enough, there is the relationship. There is a strong relationship between having experienced adverse childhood experiences when they were young and reports of food insecurity when they're older and as adults taking care of their own children. So it turns out the higher your ACEs, the more severe your food insecurity is.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about hunger in America with Mariana Chilton, a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger. You also founded the Center for Hunger-Free Communities, where you launched Witness to Hunger. So it's a movement to increase women's participation in the national dialogue on hunger and poverty. And you note that their voices have often been absent from policy discussions. So can you tell me about how Witness to Hunger is trying to remedy that?
Yes, well, Witnesses to Hunger was a really exciting project. And, you know, one of the many reasons I started Witnesses to Hunger was, first of all, women were quite silenced in the national dialogue about hunger and poverty. They're the ones who have, as I said in the beginning of our interview, they often have much higher rates of food insecurity and hunger than do male-headed households or two-parent households. So I wanted to find a way to make sure that women, who are the true experts on hunger and poverty, could have a voice at the national level and could be speaking directly to policymakers and speaking directly to the press, not as sort of a pitiful person who uses a food pantry or participates in SNAP, but as an activist, as an agent of change, as someone who actually knows what that experience is like and how to solve it. And that for me was extremely important to make sure that I, as a scientist, am out of the way and that the women can speak for themselves. It's extremely important they represent their own expertise and be able to continue to inform policy. But back to the painting, back to Julene's image that she created, she wrote on the painting, "Teach me, I remember, show me, I forget, involve me, I remember, I understand." So back to Julene, again, the woman who created that painting for me, that self-portrait, she insisted that she be involved, not just so that she can understand, but actually because she can actually teach the world about what that experience is like and what needs to change in America. So the members of Witnesses to Hunger used photography. I gave them digital cameras. This was before the smartphone. I started it in 2008. And they took photographs with their digital cameras about what they wanted to show the world. Not sort of like, poor me, this is my experience and isn't this sad, but more about, this is what I want you to see. And this is why I'm showing it to you, and this is what I want you to do as a community leader or as a legislator. So the photographs that they took, we created exhibits, over two dozen exhibits all across the East Coast, in city halls, in state houses, and our exhibit was at the United States Congress, at the United States Senate in 2009 in the Russell Rotunda, and we were at the House of Representatives twice. Talk in where the members of Witnesses to Hunger could speak directly to legislators. They were speaking directly to senators and congresspeople about what that experience was like. And back in 2009, early 2009, when we were at the United States Senate, almost immediately there was an increase after that to SNAP benefits. Because the women, members of Witnesses were talking about how important SNAP was to their health and well-being and to their ability to feed their families and also to make choices about what was best for their families. Witnesses to Hunger we were in multiple cities on the East Coast. We were in Philadelphia, Camden, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, and New Haven, Connecticut. The program lasted in Philadelphia for over 12 years, and it's still going on in New Haven, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So people, if they want to learn more about what Witnesses to Hunger is up to now, check them out. They're in New Haven, and they're very active in their community and nationally.
I wanted to go over some definitions or phrases that the government uses to assess need. What is considered food insecure, or the phrase very low food security? What's that? What does it mean to be considered food insecure?
Oh, well, it starts to get complicated. But we do have an official measure that the United States Department of Agriculture had been using for over 25 years. And so, as I said before, food insecurity is lack of access to enough food for an active and healthy life. And the official measure is an 18-point measure. And the first two questions are, I can't, I probably should read it straight from my book, but off the top of my head, I've been asking these questions for many, many years. Did you ever worry about running out of food before you got money to buy more? So part of that is anxiety about having enough money for food. And then the next question was, did you ever run out of money? Or did you ever run out of food before you had money to buy more? It's almost the same question, but it's this idea about running out of food, in other words, having enough. And th those, even if you answer yes to either of those questions, you're considered to be potentially marginally food secure, which people don't think is that serious. Well, then it goes deeper. And there are questions of, did you change the quality of your meals because you didn't have enough money for food? And it goes further on into deeper questions of, did you ever not eat for a whole day because you didn't have enough money for food? And it goes even deeper with families with children. Then they ask questions about the children. Did the children ever not eat for a whole day because there wasn't enough money for food? And that gets into the most severe forms of food insecurity. Now, it gets a little bit more complicated in terms of the measure, but overall, people should remember that just the mar even the anxiety of having enough money for food, we have found as scientists that it's very much related to higher hospitalization rates, and to kids having more colds and ear infections, young children, and kids not being able to pay attention in school. So even the mildest forms of food insecurity can have major health consequences for families, for mothers of children. We know it's related to de depressive symptoms and anxiety. And school-age children, not only does it mean that they're more likely to not behave well in school, but they won't be able to perform very well in school as well. And this is why programs like SNAP are so important. We know that when families receive SNAP, that their kids do better in school on math and reading tests. So it's a proven remedy that we really should not be allowing people to have any anxiety about having enough money for food.
But talking about SNAP, you also write that modern day public assistance programs are forms of entrapment constructed by big companies, facilitated by the US government and their policies. So the US government is basically like pimping out women and children to American corporations. What led you to this conclusion that, so because you're saying SNAP is a good thing, but it's also entrapment?
Yes. Well, this is why I had to write a book about it. I needed some real time to start unpacking things. And really, who taught me this, the underbelly of what was going on with SNAP were the members of Witnesses to Hunger. So I remember when the women were showing their photographs, one woman showed me a picture of a chain. She says, "Mariana, this is welfare. Welfare is like a chain." And at first I thought, ooh, that's really kind of falling into right-wing propaganda about what is happening with public assistance programs. I asked her to unpack that a little more, and she said, "I work so hard in order to feed my family, but it's still not enough. So I have to participate in the food stamp program." This is another name for SNAP. And what happens is, if I get a raise or I work overtime, especially around the Christmas or around the holidays, we're coming up to those now, in order to buy some things for the kids and feed the family a little, something festive, I'm concerned that I will lose my SNAP benefits because if I go over the eligibility criteria for SNAP, then I'll lose them. So what we call this the cliff effect. So what happens oftentimes is that when working parents start earning more money and lose their SNAP benefits, they're hungrier than they were before because they don't have SNAP. So that sort of, it's like a catch-22 that they were talking about. And this was something that I was not invited to talk about a lot among my colleagues who work on food insecurity and hunger because it gets more complicated. It gets then and people start taking that top of mind type of concept that welfare is like a chain and we should not have it. The reason that people participate in SNAP, the vast majority of adults who participate in SNAP are working, but their wages are so low that they have to supplement those wages with SNAP and Medicaid benefits. So I'll explain how this works. I'll just take Walmart as an example. They are the largest employer in the United States, and they are the largest redeemer of SNAP benefits. They redeem 25% of SNAP benefits in the United States. What happens is Walmart can pay people low wages because they know the federal government will come in with SNAP and Medicaid benefits. And so Walmart is also actively lobbies to keep wages low because it increases their profits. So the SNAP and Medicaid help the big corporations increase their profits because they refuse to pay a living wage. So this is it's the underbelly of what's going on with public assistance programs. We really should not have SNAP in this country. We're the only country that has a program like this in the world. And that's because other countries like Australia, their minimum wage is $25 an hour. And there are, you know, substantial unemployment benefits when families can't work or lose their jobs, or when a person who gives birth, they have to take care of their young child. There are great supports for those families. SNAP is deeply tied to big corporations in the United States.
So you're saying if Walmart paid all their employees more, or if the minimum wage was more, then there'd be less people on SNAP, so then less people would be getting groceries at Walmart. It's a cycle.
Well, they may be still going to Walmart. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
It depends on where people really like to shop. But yeah. Yes, that is what I'm saying, is that actually if corporations paid a living wage, there would be no need for SNAP. Now, other folks who participate in SNAP are people with disabilities. We have disability benefits in this country, but the disability benefits are woefully inadequate. So people then try to participate in SNAP to help supplement. 40% of people with disabilities experience food insecurity. That tells you that the assistance programs that we have for disabled folks is not enough. It's not robust enough. So we have to take a much broader look at how we take care of each other in the United States. For those who can work, they should make a living wage so that they can pay their rent or their mortgage on time. They can pay for utilities and pay for food and live a flourishing life, as do many people, you know, millions of people in Western Europe and in Australia do.
Mariana Chilton is author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, and is staying with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about some solutions. Where do we go from here? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about hunger, why it persists, whether federal food assistance programs work, and is there a better way? Still with us is longtime researcher Mariana Chilton, a professor of practice in the Department of Nutrition at UMass Amherst. She's also the founder of the Center for Hunger-Free Communities, where she launched Witnesses to Hunger, a movement to increase women's participation in the national dialogue on hunger and poverty. And she's the author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, Why We Must Unlearn Everything We Think We Know and Start Again. Thanks again for being here, Mariana.
Glad to be here.
So from your book subtitle that I just said, what would starting again look like, I guess, in a perfect world? What do we need to start again?
Well, in my book, I talk about the roots of disrespect, discrimination against women, discrimination against people of color, and discrimination against the people who are poor is really at the roots of who we are in the United States. The United States was founded on genocide of Native people and stealing their lands. This is another reason why Native folks have the highest rates of food insecurity and hunger in America. And it's founded on the transatlantic slave trade, on enslavement, which is really those two things, genocide and enslavement, at the roots of modern capitalism today. We're still seeing those dynamics. So I talk about, you know, how we can start to have the courage to look at what's really going on, about how it is possible that our society can allow such brilliant and wonderful people like Julene and Celeste and Joanna experience such hardship. This is telling us something about who we are. So I talk about the need to transform our political systems, our economic systems, but also to transform ourselves. And this is why I talk about three domains of interlocking solutions. So what different ways of thinking about it are, first of all, yes, political solutions. We need to focus on widespread political solutions, such as an alternative to SNAP. First of all, living wages, number one. Secondly, supports for families who are working. So we need to make sure that we have paid family leave, paid maternity and paternity leave, and paid leave for when families are sick. That helps people not, you know, when a young child gets sick, they have to take off from work. That means that's money they're missing. That means they miss their paying their rent bill. That means they don't have enough money for food. So we should have the kinds of work supports or labor supports that help people stay healthy and sane and, you know, contributing to their communities when they're working. And we need to have good disability benefits. As well, another political solution is universal health care. There is no reason that having health care should be tied to whether you're working or not. And again, that's in a high-paying job. It certainly doesn't happen with companies like Walmart, who refuse to provide health care for their employees. So we should have universal health care so people don't feel like they, first of all, they're not dependent on that low wage in order to get the Medicaid benefits, or this new concept that the Trump administration is working on, such as work requirements in order to get health care. People should have access to health care just because they're human beings, in order to stay healthy. Another political solution is universal breakfast and lunch. School children, when they go to school, everyone should be able to get lunch and breakfast. We know that school breakfast and school lunch actually promotes good school performance, and kids are more likely to stay in school when they can access breakfast and lunch. Those are major political solutions that we need to think about. But in order to do that, I'm going back to Jolene's self-portrait when she's looking at you. It goes deeper than that because, you know, a lot of people can sort of bypass how they feel about what's going on and sort of not even think about racism and discrimination when they're thinking about universal health care. But knowing that racism and discrimination against women especially, are so important to think to how food insecurity happens in this country, we have to undo racism and discrimination in ourselves. So the three interlocking domains are political, and then personal and spiritual. And this is where we get into the personal ways of doing things. We have to look into ourselves. How willing have we been individually and personally and in our families to allow violence against women to happen? We should think about what is something in our society. We have a society that is so steeped in trying to dominate each other. I think the current Trump administration is a major manifestation of trying to dominate the American people and trying to force them into accepting authoritarianism and other kinds of things. So we need to transform our society. In order to do that, we need to transform ourselves and no longer allow ourselves to tolerate discrimination against women, discrimination against folks who are Black, who are Native. And that means bringing in more love. And because, again, I talk about how trauma is underneath food insecurity and hunger. So if that trauma goes so deep into our society, into who we are, we need to find better ways to love ourselves and to love each other. And this is why I talk about the spiritual domain that should be interlocking with the political and the personal domain. It takes multiple ways of looking at this issue of food insecurity and hunger. And by spiritual, I mean, we need to develop a more loving way of being in the world. The way that food insecurity gets expressed or happens is because we disrespect each other. So I'm trying to learn, how can we start to respect each other? How can we start to treat each other with a sense of compassion, care, reciprocity, and mutuality? And knowing that we need care and reciprocity and mutuality in our society to end hunger, how do we bring that love, care, and mutuality and compassion into policymaking? How do we bring it into our own lives? And how do we bring it to our own families? So it gets to be pretty deep, but we can do it. We can transform our society. We make the world that we live in. You know, these are our systems. Hunger is man-made, so we can undo hunger by loving each other more.
Late in the book, you write that to solve hunger in America, we must come to account with the truth, no matter how painful. Healing collective trauma demands our collective attention. So what does that look like to you? Does it mean an apology? Does it mean reparations? Does it mean that spiritual component, just more love that you are talking about?
Thank you so much for bringing that in. Yes, all that you mentioned. Again, back to genocide and enslavement, there's never been an apology to Native folks that is a meaningful apology. Native people need their land back. They say that's one of the major reasons that they're experiencing food insecurity and hunger, that they've lost their lands that they could farm, their hunting lands, their fishing rights. We need to make sure that they have access to that and that we have a more pluralistic way of doing. So land back for Indigenous people and for people who are descendants of slaves. The reason that that more Black people are food insecure in this country is because there is racism in the workplace, racism in our educational systems, racism in healthcare. So it's not Black people's fault that they're poorer. It's because our systems continuously, systematically deprive Black folks of living well and doing well. So there need to be reparations. Back when the emancipation happened, people who were slaves were promised 40 acres and a mule. And we still have not provided that. The U.S. government has still not provided those reparations. There's a bill in both the Senate and in the House for reparations. That's just to even investigate or to look at it. Mm-hmm. Like what it actually even look at. It's not even giving reparations. It's just starting to look at it. What we need to do in America is start to get over our own fear of being afraid of looking at who we are as a country and looking at the pain that we have caused each other and the own pain that we are experiencing ourselves. So yes, again, those political solutions, reparations, land back, universal health care, universal school breakfast and lunch, paid family leave. But in order to do that, we have to transform ourselves. We have to be more willing to talk about love, stop trying to dominate each other and control each other, treat each other with respect, dignity and care. In order to do that, we have to become more spiritual. And by that, it also gives us courage to have a look back to Julene's painting. She's looking at us. Do we have the courage to look back and to be accountable to her?
We only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to bring it back to what we were talking about earlier with SNAP going away for a period of time and SNAP being in flux. Why aren't food pantries the answer? You write in the book that even food bank programs like Feeding America, one of the largest nonprofits in the country, emergency food systems are just not the answer. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, I can. The food bank started popping up in the 1980s. And earlier in our interview, we asked, what have American presidents thought about SNAP programs? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about Ronald Reagan. I didn't get there. Now I can. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan vilified people who were on food stamps and other kinds of public supports programs and started calling up racism and gender discrimination to try to get people to think against folks who were participating in public assistance programs. Well, it worked pretty well. They started pulling back the money out of food stamps. They started pulling the money out of welfare programs, other kinds of welfare programs. And because people were struggling so much, people started developing food pantries. And then the big corporations thought, ooh, we can look really positive and wonderful if we give some of our money to Feeding America. It wasn't called Feeding America then, but to food banks. And then our reputation is unsullied. We can continue to pay low wages, but then we look like we're the good guys because we're giving money to the food pantries. Again, food pantries have no accountability in that. You have no rights when you show up. You're a passive recipient. That means you just have to take what you're given. And sometimes their hours are inconsistent. If you're working, you can't show up to the food pantries on time. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to have more control over the food that you're feeding your family. And what people want to do is they want to buy their own food. I have not talked to one person who enjoys going to a food pantry or food bank. They're humiliated by it. They want to go to a place where they feel like there's good dignity, that they belong to the community, that they're a part of our society. And that's something that we also need to think about is belonging. How can we build more programs that are help to promote belonging? So I think Feeding America, one of the best ways that they could address hunger in America is if they became a giant food cooperative. And then people would be proud to participate in that cooperative because they know that they're contributing to feeding other people at the same time that they may be benefiting from the program.
We are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking about hunger this hour with the author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America, Why We Must Unlearn Everything We Think We Know and Start Again. Mary Ann Chilton is also a professor of practice in the Department of Nutrition at UMass Amherst. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mariana.
Thank you for having me. It was a delight.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.